So we're like at 50 seconds. So the lack of zoomies is because of the wrong link, probably.
I'm not sure.
Hmm.
Is there another link button that we're confusing people?
I don't know. A lot of people are getting the authentication message.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think we can begin without a quorum as long as we're not conducting any votes.
Yeah, people start.
And we are at our 10-second mark. Okay, let's begin. Welcome. I'm Jonathan Oxhorn, Senate Speaker, Professor Emeritus from Architecture. We start with the land acknowledgement. Cornell University is located on the traditional homelands of the Gayokono, the Cayuga Nation. The Gayokono are members of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy, an alliance of six sovereign nations with a historic and contemporary presence on this land. The Confederacy precedes the establishment of Cornell University, New York State, and the United States of America. We acknowledge the painful history of Gayokono dispossession and honor the ongoing connection of Gayokono people, past and present, to these lands and waters. So the meeting is called to order. The first order of business is approval of the minutes from September 14th, 2022. They have been posted, distributed online in the form of a verbatim transcript. So there shouldn't be any corrections, but if there are any, please raise your hand or whether in person or online. Seeing none, I will assume the minutes are approved through unanimous consent. We're now ready for Senate announcements and updates. Eve DeRosa, Dean of Faculty, and Chelsea Specht, Associate Dean of Faculty, have 5 minutes, and then there'll be question and answers for 5 minutes after that.
Good afternoon, everyone. Can you hear me? Thanks. So we've had some technical issues today, so we will try our best. Hopefully everyone will join us in time. And I will also try to speak in the mic while looking at slides that are behind me. So I just wanted to make an announcement that there is a new data science minor, and I'm going to move the slides. It's a cross-college minor, and it involves the College of Arts and Sciences, CALS, Computing and Information Sciences, Engineering, and the School of Industrial and Labor Relations. And this is a curriculum that will give recognition to our undergraduates for an expertise in data science. It involves six courses, and it will be administered by the Statistics Department, which is also a multi-college entity. And any minor changes to the minor will take place through a curriculum committee that's organized by all of the contributing colleges. Next slide, please. I just wanted to say thank you to those of you who did vote. And for the 33 that did not vote, don't forget that an abstention is still an expression of engagement. And so hopefully we'll minimize that 33 did not vote. And if you have any technical issues with the Qualtrics link, just let our office know and we'll resend it. We are the university is about to engage everyone in a work-life survey. And I just wanted to let you know that our research teaching extension faculty task force, they had questions that they generated for RTE faculty. And we were able to incorporate those into the survey. And it's going to not just go to RTE faculty, but all faculty, the university faculty as well. And the work-life survey is for currently employed faculty members at Cornell. And so the two larger classes of questions were clear expectations for career investment, advancement, and the ability to express your opinion and that it's valued. We are going to have a faculty forum looking at the future of academic communication. This is the first one of the year. So on October 26th, we will have a remote format only, and it's voluntary. So there's no compulsory attendance. You come if you're interested in the topic and you want to contribute to the conversation. And we're looking at how will archived trade books, open access publications, et cetera, be valued. Next slide. These are the things that are coming in November. So President Pollack is coming to the Senate. If there are particular content areas that you would like to have discussed, please email the office and we will discuss it in the University Faculty Committee. The University Faculty Committee will be also looking at the pilot program that is happening right now with student disability services accommodations. So there's a breadth of classes that have used this centralized testing organization, and we're seeing, we're going to learn how that's been going and seeing if it does relieve the burden on faculty to really address a multitude of accommodations and styles of accommodation. And then there's also a proposal from SDS to have a faculty advisory committee. So we'll learn more about what that might be and what we might want. And of course, feel free to email us if there are other topics that you would like the University Faculty Committee to consider. And for those of you who are on the University Faculty Committee, if you could just stand or put up your virtual hand on Zoom, that would be wonderful. And so both Chelsea and I are available for questions, as well as the University Faculty Committee members. And then the last thing that we wanted to update you on is that the Nominations and Elections Committee is meeting monthly, as we mentioned last time. And so this month, we are trying to address the composition of these committees here. So the Academic Freedom and Professional Status of the Faculty, the A.D. White Professor at Large Program, Financial Policies Committee, Committee on Music, and the University ROTC Relationships. And just trying to get a breadth of disciplines and colleges represented in the committee. And that's all of our updates and announcements. Next slide, please.
So if you're in Zoom land, raise your virtual hand. If you're in person and have a question or comment, just please step up to the microphone. And I will wait a second or two. I don't see any hands. So I think we will move on to the next Senate agenda item, which is the AFPSF, Academic Freedom and Professional Status of the Faculty Committee update. Tracy Stokel, chair, has 5 minutes, and then there will also be a Q&A for 5 minutes after that. Is state Tracy here or online? So Tracy, if you hear me, you can unmute yourself and start speaking. Okay. Is it possible to move on to the next agenda item? Is public safety here or available? Maybe that's a good idea. And then assuming unanimous consent for this rearrangement of the minutes, let's go to the public safety division. A presentation from Joanne DiStefano, Executive Vice President and Chief Financial Officer, and David Honan, Associate Vice President of Public Safety, for 15 minutes in any order that you'd like, and then 15 minutes for discussion. And you are here. So welcome.
Just right to the mic. Okay. Thank you for having me. Joanne Stefano is finishing up some trustee meetings, so she's going to join us online when she can. Now that we're early, we might miss her altogether. So go ahead, next slide. I'm going to talk about the new Division of Public Safety and some of the efforts that we're putting forth to consolidate all of our public safety functions into one area so we can provide some seamless transition between different departments. A little bit of background first, though. We have a public safety advisory committee on campus. It's a longstanding committee. It's actually established by New York State law as to what it is and what it's supposed to be doing. Even its composition, it has to have a third faculty, a third staff, third students. It has to be at least half female. And it's supposed to advise the campus of public safety. So part of President Pollack's initiatives on racial justice back in 2020, she tasked the PSAC to come up with new methods to reimagine public safety here on campus and elevated it to report to Executive Vice President Joanne DeStefano. Next slide. So we spent most of the year, and we, I'm an advisor to the committee. The committee works independently, but I'm there to answer questions and provide any background or data that they may want. But they came up with four recommendations, which you can find on the Public Safety Advisory Committee's website. The whole report is there. But much of it was about a public statement, a commitment for anti-racist policy, and developing and implementing an alternative public safety response model, educational campaign for public safety calls, and diversification of the public safety workforce. A lot of the time last year was spent on this developing alternative public safety response models. In fact, SEL had already started with a group that we called the Community Response Team. And we got that up and running kind of while we were still doing a lot of the work. So we did some good things and we did a couple things that we were like, okay, that's a good lesson to learn as to how we can improve. So next slide. So we deployed the Community Response Team. But while that was deployed, the PSAC was doing a pretty intense call review of all the calls that come into the dispatch center. And we were sending officers on to really try to figure out what calls do we not need police officers on? What do we have Cornell Police going to that you don't need a police officer? They were only going because they're the only people here at 9 o'clock at night, 3 in the morning, weekends. And what if we had this other group that could take on some of these calls? And we also talked about some call diversion. You know, where can we divert calls that just don't need a police officer? So a lot of that has been done over the past year. The PSAC membership was diversified. We had a presentation in one of the meetings. We had a lot of different speakers throughout the year, but we had Cornell EMS, which is a student-run organization, all volunteer. They're all EMTs. And if anybody's an EMT or knows one, you know the amount of training that they have to go through. They came and did a presentation and the group decided that we should have them as part of the PSAC, as a member of the public safety neighborhood here at Cornell. And what they do is they, in addition to response to medical calls, they're a first responder. When you dial 911 and you need medical, the group you get might be this student run group, but they also do standbys at student events, saving student groups a lot of money. They don't charge for their services. And they provide a very good basic life support level of care. So if you don't need an ambulance, usually it's EMS that comes, can care for you. And if you sign off and don't need transport, you're on your way. And it's a fantastic group. And if anybody wants more information about that, I'd be happy to talk about that. And right now, you know, and I talked about the lessons learned. You know, we learned that we had a group that didn't have a clinician. And without a clinician, you're limited on what you can do to take people to the hospital and to be engaged. So a lot of the national models are using a clinician and then like paraprofessionals in caseworker roles. So we're moving into, or we're hiring right now, there's a post open for a clinician to be the director of the community response team. And then the next few weeks, we're going to start advertising for the caseworkers that'll be working for that clinician. And we're hoping to get them up and running as soon as possible. And then in the spring, to put this all together, we announced a new public safety organization. Some of the feedback that we received, and Griggler, the next slide, was that, you know, people wouldn't call the 255 and 1111 number. used Rave Guardian, blew their phone because they thought they were just calling the police. So that's when really put together the data that PSAC was looking at, some of the feedback from the community. We needed to have the dispatch center pulled out of the police department and removed. And we needed to bring EMS in, and we needed to put everything together. So on the customer side, or on the student, staff, or faculty side that's calling for services, it's seamless. And they just call for help. The public safety dispatch center, which is all staffed by civilian, they're not police officers. They're trained up to national standards for 911. In fact, we are the backup 911 center for Tompkins County. They should go down. All those calls will be handled here. So I stepped down from my role as chief of police at that time. And we promoted Deputy Chief Tony Bellamy up to be chief of police. And Tony is a fantastic partner. He values collaboration with the community. And I couldn't think of a better person for us to start these changes with within the police department role. Next slide. So what does it look like? What am I all bringing together and pulling apart? I'm at the top of the AVP there. And then we pulled apart the dispatch center out of the police department. And that's our technical operations on the left, which is public safety communications, dispatch, Rave Guardian rings into them. They monitor all of our alarms, burglar, fire, research. There's different research areas that have different alarms that we need to monitor. That's all handled in there. CU Police, that is all staying within the police department. Another group that we brought over into public safety was emergency management. They handle all of our emergency preparedness, our business continuity plans, and they play a key role in any major event. But the most important role they play is planning, so we're prepared when there is an event that happens. So they're working with us now. Alternative response, CRT, that's what we're working on right now. They came over from SCL. Once we had CRT up and running, and I'm sure I'd be happy to come back and talk about this when we get this next piece up and running, we're going to be developing a campus service officer. And we don't know a name for it yet, so that's just a name to kind of hold the place. And that's going to be an unarmed, non-sworn person to handle, again, service calls that you don't need a trained clinician or you don't need a police officer. That you need somebody in a somewhat authoritative role that can come and keep an eye and advise on safety. One of the main things that I see for this is our walking escorts that we do at night, the blue light escorts. Random patrol just around campus, looking for lights out, safety hazards, disturbance calls, disorderly conduct, things that don't need a police officer. But you need somebody to go say, hey, we got a call. Can you keep the noise down? The biggest thing I want to try to get this group connected with is some of our student events, that because they're late at night, they need some security. And right now they either get a police officer from Cornell Police or they get a contract security person. And our contract security folks do a really good job. They're trained, they're up to our standards, but they are just not Cornell. They're not our people. I want people in these positions that know how to treat our community and take care of our community and are accountable to us and the environment that we're creating here. So we'll be working on that next. There's other administrative operations such as Clery compliance and access control, and there's a lot of records. So New York State recently changed a lot of the discovery laws, which require a lot of administrative work to get records done much faster, much quicker. And there's a whole unit that handles all of that. And then I was talking about EMS. One thing I didn't mention is they do a lot of educational programming. So if you want to have CPR training, AED training, stop the bleed, the students will come in and do that training again, free of charge. So when I've been talking to students, you know, they were like, well, what's different about what you're doing? What's changed? So I'm trying to find different ways to represent, you know, what it is that we did. So this was the common understanding of, if you had a crisis before, you called CUPD, the officer responded, and there was either an arrest, a referral, warning, sent to the student conduct office or fraternity and sorority affairs. And that was pretty much it. And that was the basic understanding for what happened. The new section is a little bit more complicated, but I want to highlight that when you have a crisis, that it goes to the public safety 911 center now. So they evaluate what the appropriate response is. And once we have CRT up and running, it'll be the mobile crisis team. If it's a non-violent, non-criminal, especially a mental health call that just doesn't need a police officer, that's where that's going to go. That's going to be, you know, students that are distressed, students that are maybe, you know, not the point of being a missing person, but nobody's seen them in a little while. So instead of sending a police officer to go knock on their door, which absolutely scares them, we're going to send somebody that's a clinician that can talk to them, you know, through the conversation. Do they need help? Is there something going on? And then the groups in the middle, so between EMS, police, and CRT, it's going to be fluid between there. So if CRT gets there and it really is something needs a police officer, police will show up. We want to make sure our police officers are trained that when they get there, it just doesn't need a police officer. They can hand that off to the CRT. And there's programs nationwide that are working very well in this area. CAHOOTS is one of them that you'll hear referenced a lot. They've been in place since like 1979, 1980 in Oregon. And it's a model that a lot of national crisis response teams are starting to follow. And then from there, any of those groups can then make sure people are connected to the appropriate resources, the hospital, university services, crisis management, CAPS, Cornell Health, Res Life. You know, there's a variety of different services that we provide to students here on campus. Or if they're a student or an older student or not a student at all, sometimes the people we deal with are just not students. So there's community services, and there's a lot of them here in Ithaca. But we're not going to say, well, you're not a student, so we're just not do nothing. We're going to get you connected to the right community service. If there's police, the police can do student conduct or in rare cases, the criminal justice system. 911 center will also dispatch to fire and EMS, even they're not part of, just fire. They're not part of public safety, but we still work very closely with environmental health and safety, the Ithaca Fire Department, Cuyahoga Heights Fire Department. And off to the left, I want to highlight the crisis hotline. So we're trying to get word out about, if you read my weekly message, I did one about 988. So if you're having a mental health crisis, you can call 988 and speak to a national counselor, or they can actually get you connected here, somebody in Tompkins County. And they can help connect you with local services, campus services, and they can help walk through outside of the public safety system. That's a new number and a new resource for people to use to get help. And, you know, they may recommend you go to the hospital, or they may recommend that we get involved at some point and help you get to the hospital. So that would be a CRT in this case. And hopefully between get this all working in the next year or so, we hope that the community sees just a seamless, seamless delivery. And what the point is we care about our community. We care about delivering the service, not, making arrests or writing tickets or the things that the people had an image of the police department for. Want this to be handled seamlessly between my groups to make sure we're delivering the right services to the community. So we finished a lot of the data gathering analysis. Chief and I are out making public appearances, and this is one of them. I meet with a lot of student groups. So we did the surveys, we did focus groups, we did a lot of outreach during the start of this. But now that we're getting to the point we've done CRT for a year, we're making some refinements. I want to be connected with student groups, faculty senate, employee groups. Are we doing it right? Is this what people are looking for? And I'm trying to get feedback. So I'm happy to take any questions when we're done here. And even after here, if you think anything, just drop me an email. You can reply to my weekly message, or you can just drop me an email at honan@cornell.edu. And I'd be happy to take any feedback even outside of here. We're in the middle of revamping all the position descriptions. So I said we had the director that's out there. We're just finishing up the caseworker. So that should be out very shortly. And we talked about the unarmed campus service officer, and then rebranding. One of the pieces of feedback that I'm getting from student groups especially are we associate the 255-1111 with the police. We want to rebrand that so people understand that number calls our public safety dispatch center now. If you use Rave Guardian, that goes to the public safety dispatch center. If you pick up a blue light, that goes to the public safety dispatch center. So if you dial 911 from campus phone, same thing. So we're going to do a little bit more work. I'm trying to get some more student feedback on what we can do to rebrand this appropriately. I really want to get that rebranding out there when we get the CRT up and running. I think that'll be good to push those messages out simultaneously. And I think that's it. So happy to take any questions.
If you have questions, please just step up to the microphone if you're in person. And if you're online, please raise your digital hand.
Sure. Okay. Thank you, David. That was great. And I
state
really
your name,
like please. The CRT idea. My name is Ken Berman, a computer science senator. I have a question that dates back, I think, a year and a half ago. There was a gunfight down in town. Someone fled with a weapon into Cayuga Heights. It provoked a town response, and we knew that the town police were following the individual and a lockdown on campus. It concerned me because we have a lot of young people of color on campus, and it seemed to me that it created a high risk of an incident. And I'm wondering how your office is engaging with the city to ensure that when there's a response in a situation like that, it's your people responding as opposed to city officers who may not understand the context up here and could make a mistake.
So thank you. That was a challenging case because of it not being on campus, but when they started putting out alerts and in the direction that the suspects were running, it was coming towards North Campus. Being the fact that there was just a shooting immediately previous to that, we thought that there was a risk to our campus, and that's when we put out the messages. Now, talking about the messages alone, we took some learnings out of that. We learned that not everybody knows what North Campus is. We need to use some more thorough descriptors as to what North Campus is. Not every building coordinator understands what they should be doing. So we're working between emergency management and building coordinators to understand what you should be doing. It's a large campus. So a lockdown, you know, as you picture in the K-12 setting, isn't the same thing. We have 280 buildings in, you know, multiple jurisdictions. So North Campus is very different than far out East Campus, say at the vet school. How do we work together? So in that particular case, we were monitoring the radio traffic in advance before any of the alerts came out. We heard that the subjects got out and they were running through Cayuga Heights. We actually sent officers up there to assist Cayuga Heights, and then we placed officers in North Campus to respond to any concerns that came into us. So we made sure our officers were responding. You know, what was not put out through the alerts is we had a pretty thorough description. A couple of the officers saw the suspect, so they had a really good description of who we were looking for. And I heard, you know, plenty of concerns from the community, from parents. You know, my son or daughter is Black, and I see that. I heard that description come out, which was put out through some local media. And, you know, I talked to them and I assured them that we know who we're looking for. We see the description. It's a much more thorough description than just a Black male. But that was not something we put out publicly. You know, I worked with the Faculty Senate previously to make sure we're not putting racial descriptions in our alerts and in our crime alerts that come out. But we made sure the officers know who they were looking for, and they were pretty close, and we didn't catch them that night. And say we as the larger context of municipal law enforcement in the campus, but they were eventually caught up in Rochester and brought that case to a close. I hope I answered your question.
Well, we have some online questions or comments. Ashley Newman, unmute yourself.
Hi, yeah, Ashley Newman, at large senator from the vet school. My question was, if a student or faculty, staff, anyone were to call 911 from their cell phone on campus, they would likely get directed to the Tompkins County Emergency Response, not this new community response network with all of the different resources that you outlined. So is it only that when you use a campus phone, you can reach that network, or how were someone on campus that isn't near a campus phone could reach that network and get the help that they need that isn't maybe just directly to the Tompkins County Police Department?
So you're exactly right. If you dial 911 from a cell phone, it goes to the County 911 Center. We work very closely with them, and they vet out calls that are directed for Cornell. If somebody identifies that they are a member of the Cornell community on our campus, they route that call to us. So that would fall into the Public Safety Communication Center. How we would like our communication or our public to contact us, if you want to be sure you're getting our communication center, use Rave Guardian. You can text, you can call, you can communicate with our public safety center right off that app. And if you want, you can hit a button and it'll say where you are if you can't talk and you need help. We also like the blue lights or down the 607-255-1111 number. That goes directly to our center. Work is being done on, you know, is there a way to get calls more efficiently to us? We don't have a solution right now, but it's something we are looking at as to how we might be able to get those cell phone calls on campus to us in a more timely manner.
Okay, we have an in-person question and comment, and then we'll go online again.
Hi, Tom Fox from Molecular Biology and Genetics. So in the review of your calls, I'm just curious, what proportion roughly did you decide didn't need to go to sworn officers? And if it was large, do you anticipate shrinking the police force?
So right now, there's no plan on shrinking the police force. This is supplement because the police force, remember, as our campus has grown by people and by area over many years, the police force has never added people in many, many years. In fact, we lost security guards many years ago that we had that just were never, they weren't replaced with police officers. So what was, I think what we've learned out of that was, what are we going to send these folks to and not send police officers? And it's our check the welfares. It's our minor disturbances, mental health calls that don't involve weapons, don't involve an imminent threat. And you know, what are the numbers? Roughly, there's officers respond to mental health calls on a regular basis, almost daily during the school year. So there's, you know, a good number of calls. I'm sorry, I don't have the numbers right in front of me, but I'll be better prepared next time and happy to discuss them, at, you know, offline out of here. But, you know, if we could divert a couple calls every day just on mental health, nothing else, you know, we're having those less contacts with police for things that don't need police. Then we have various, you know, roommate disturbances. Noise complaints are a big one. We get a lot of calls from parents. And again, it's not that they're a missing person, but, you know, their son or daughter calls them every hour on the hour on a regular basis, and they haven't heard from them in 2 hours, so it must be bad. So this is something that you don't, you know, it really scares our students to have a police officer show up at their door because they haven't talked to their mom in a couple hours. So we can divert it off into this group here. There's also the aftermath. So, you know, we go, say there is a serious call, and it's pretty dynamic when there's a serious medical call or a serious criminal call in a residence hall in particular. So the police show up, EMS shows up, maybe the ambulance, and everybody's there, and they're managing the situation at hand, but there's a lot of disruption to that community. So this is going to be an added level that the police would just leave before, and then people are like, wonder what's going on? What did I do? Or, you know, there's some people would actually call 911, but then feel like they didn't do the right thing because there was no closure with them. So this is going to provide somebody in a social worker, clinician context that can sit with that person afterwards and say, wow, that was pretty intense. Are you okay? And then make sure we close that loop with people who are not the victim or the person that needed the medical attention, but the bystanders that it, you know, it disrupts that whole area. So I don't see a shortage of many of these programs of work to do. I think many of these programs, they start out a couple people like we are, but then they slowly grow. And one learning that we had last year was we limited this group to the residence halls, and the students just need care anywhere they are on campus. So this group will be campus-wide, wherever they're needed.
Risa Lieberwitz.
Yeah, thank you. Risa Lieberwitz, faculty senator from ILR. Thanks for the presentation. Regarding alternative public safety models, could you comment on how that may relate to issues of the relationship between the police and campus protests, whether those are, large groups, smaller groups, dissent, you know, dissenting issues. I mean, you know, what happens on campuses, which is part of academic freedom and the ability to express ourselves, whether we're students or faculty or staff. And those might be on social issues, they may be on political issues. And so I wonder if you could comment on that issue of the relationship between the police and campus protests and whether these alternatives are related at all to that.
So the alternatives aren't directly related to that, but you know, as you're speaking, I'm thinking that there's a good opportunity here. And you know, the police are committed to protecting people's First Amendment speech rights. The right to freedom of speech is important. But again, when we only had police for protests that were not disruptive, were not violent, had nothing, that were just expressive opportunities to use your First Amendment rights, all we had was police. And if we have these alternative service providers, I don't see CRT as being the key to that. But I think our new alternative response in the unarmed could certainly help with the traffic. You know, we try to, if students go into a roadway, we don't want to see somebody hit. The officers were closing down the road. We can use traffic. We can use these unarmed folks to do things like that. So I hope I answered your question.
Well, just follow up quickly, you know, having been at various campus protests over the years here, it's always, I think for many people, it's quite intimidating to see police officers there, armed officers, both in terms of police officers and armed officers, depending on whether they have arms. And so I wonder if that's, you know, what you're saying would lead to not having police officers armed or unarmed at protests.
Yeah, and sometimes the armed officers are there because they were the only staff we had to make sure that we could ensure their safety. You know, we worry as much about people trying to disrupt speeches or to use violence to stop these groups from speaking. And we're worried about that as well. So, you know, we've only had police officers to go and kind of get a sense for what's going on. Now we have some alternative responses, and I'd be happy to talk further and think about this more. We haven't really thought about this in the protest context, but I think it's a good thing for us to think about.
I'm waiting for other hands up or for in-person people to come down. Otherwise, could someone find out if Tracy is here to move back to the previous? Okay, so if there are no more questions or comments, thank you. And we're going to move back to the previous agenda item, assuming unanimous consent. This was the Academic Freedom and Professional Status of the Faculty Committee update. And speaking in place of Tracy Stokel will be Dean of Faculty, Eve DeRosa.
I do not look or sound like Tracy, and you do not want me to do an accent. So I attended the AFPSF, their last meeting. So I will try to represent the content that they'll be considering over this semester and this academic year. And if there are any committee members present in the room or online, just help me out, throw me a line. So it's very possible that Tracy has clinical duties. She represents the vet school. And so one topic that they are considering is how collaborations are valued. So the institution is putting resources behind moonshots and radical collaborations, yet new PIs are being assessed not based on collaboration. So how do we give value to that? And so some of the guidance that they're using are guidance that the ILR are currently using, how to have external letter writers write to your role as a collaborator. And NIH has a very delineated way of representing your value to a collaboration. And so it's not just institutional pressures, but also grant agencies like the NIH really are looking for science as a team sport. And so how do we allow new PIs to get credit for the work that they contribute? And there is another item that they wanted to give consideration to, how to map the promotion from associate professor to full professor. Can we have institutional support and guidelines in a meaningful way and mentorship? And I forgot to mention that the ASPSF last year, actually before I became the Dean of Faculty, there was a resolution presented from the ASPSF under different leadership about making the chair's letter for tenured associate professor, making that visible to externally and also to the candidate. And so this is not settled on the committee in its new composition. And so they've withdrawn it and they want to revise it and bring it back. And they also want to have a college-wide audit of all the other transparency tenure processes that have gone through the Senate, and just to be sure that the guidelines and other things that became part of the transparent process are being executed by all colleges on campus. And the other, I think, large issue that will eventually come to the Senate is that the College of Business, X number of years in, I believe it's about five or six, they have the three schools integrated into this one College of Business, and they have multiple timelines for tenure. Six for two schools out of the three, and eight for another. And so they want to harmonize the tenure clock across the three schools. And there's a proposal out there. We are bringing in College of Business faculty as ad hoc members of the AFPSF, so they can also consider that along with the College of Business and hopefully inform the ultimate outcome. And so any questions are for Tracy and me as the, Tracy's proxy?
I see that Richard Bensel has his hand up in Zoom land, so okay. Unmute yourself.
Yes, not really for Tracy, though I think she should probably present again when we have a quorum. I think, and I've sent messages, but evidently the chat is disabled. Is that true? Because the chat is disabled, members, senators, I think, have not noted that I've noted the absence of a quorum three times.
Richard, there is quorum. There are lots of people in the room, so we meet quorum.
There are, okay, how many are in the room?
25 to 30. There are eight.
Okay, good.
Minimum of
I'm glad then we have a quorum. We couldn't see senators register because the chat had been disabled, Eve. Did you disable the chat?
So I just want to let you know, Richard, that was a mistake on our part. That was not intentional.
Okay, very good. Thanks a lot.
Are you done, Richard? I guess so. We have an in-person, just identify yourself and your department.
Yeah, Thomas Bjorkman, Horticulture. So I want to thank you for paying attention to the collaboration aspect. So I and many of our colleagues are trying to put together moonshot proposals. And one of the fundamental from the beginning questions is, how will these people be evaluated if a key feature of that position is its ability to collaborate? And we quickly get mired in, if you try to have tenure and promotion procedures done through multiple departments, it's going to be a mess. And so if any clarity we can get is going to be very, very helpful for doing a good job with these.
I can share that the NIH has very delineated procedures for how to reflect contributions of junior, or I shouldn't say junior, but new investigators. And basically what it looks like is the principal investigator would write what their role is in the collaboration, what value they brought to the collaboration. And then they would have external other collaborators on the project, but also external to the university, if that's the case, write what the contributions were as well. And so, but they do have very delineated. And so that is likely where the AFPSF will go, is use that as a guidance.
Any other questions or comments? In person or online? I'm not seeing any hands. So I think we'll move to the next agenda item in that case. There's a motion to bring back the research scientist title. And again, Eve DeRosa, Dean of Faculty, and Senator Ken Berman, Computer Science, will have 15 minutes to present. That we'll discuss that motion, and then there'll be 15 minutes for discussion. So, Eve.
Hello again. I'm no longer Tracy, I'm me. So what I would like to say is this today really is a pre-motion. We fully intend for everyone to contribute and think through this with us and contribute also to the ultimate drafting of the resolution. Ken is going to present his draft thus far, but if others want to contribute and also endorse this motion, please let us know so that it can come back in the next Senate meeting. And basically, my job today is to provide some institutional context for the title. When Ken brought the draft proposal and a slideshow and research to the Office of the Dean of Faculty, then I took it to the University Faculty Committee and tried to incorporate their feedback. And essentially, they wanted an institutional perspective. And so after receiving that mandate from the University Faculty Committee, I met with academic HR, and we made sure that we have clarity. And it is a very nuanced, you'll see, perspective on the titles and how they're used. And so I just want to try to give my best overview of the research scientist title, how it's been historically involved in the university. Next slide. So research teaching extension faculty, and we're specifically thinking about research titles today. These are faculty who are here on contract and not tenure track faculty. And I just also want to make clear that there is no promotion between these different titles. So you have the two tiers of the research associate title, two tiers of research scientist title, but only in specifically in research divisions, and I'll provide context for that. And then we have three tiers of the research professor, and with very delineated, for all of them, delineated processes for promotion or advancement. Next slide, please. So we'll start historically with Resolution 42, and I'm going to slide my mic around so that I get this correct. And so in 2004, there was an approved resolution from the Faculty Senate establishing the research scientist and the principal research scientist as titles for researchers here, professional researchers and academics. And basically, the resolution there, as you can see, is that they created these two new titles in 2004. And I think Ken might even be able to provide more context for why it came to the Faculty Senate when he presents. Next slide, please. In 2015, the Senate enabled the research professor title. And at that time, and this is all three ranks, at that time, they relegated the research scientist title to research divisions only. And any new appointment outside of that had to use either research professor or research associate. So even though research scientist is on the books as an available title, at this point, it's at the discretion of the dean, and or you have to be inside of a research division and not have any tenure track lines available. And I think that's all I'll say about that. Next slide, please. And then I just wanted to give a description of the research scientist title as it is considered, that this is a principal research scientist. They can initiate new research activities. They can manage a lab and also submit proposal funding for external funding. And okay, next slide. Here are all the titles available. And so you can see for the academic titles, principal research scientists and research scientists are available. So they weren't taken out of use completely, but they've been used specifically for research divisions. But deans can actually, at their discretion, bring this title back. But is this a time for the title to become back and be able to use university-wide as
for long-term researchers at the university. Okay, next slide. And then I think the last resolution that I want to bring as a reminder for those of you who were here at the time and those of you who are new, I just wanted to provide these three resolutions so that you can understand the context of this proposal. And the last one is that the research, teaching, and extension academics were part of the employee assembly up until 2019. So in the spring of 2019, research, teaching, extension faculty were brought into the Faculty Senate with university voting rights. And so at the time that the Senate in 2015 made the decision to bring in the research professor and no longer use the research scientist, RTE were not voting members. And so that's the third resolution that I'd like to bring to you today. And Ken, come on up.
Well, thank you very, very much, Eve. And thank you, everybody, for entertaining more discussion about this endless question of the huge number of titles we have at Cornell. I want to return to 2004, when it was actually me who introduced the resolution to create research scientist titles. At that time, we were finding that Cornell was having some difficulty competing against peer institutions, and that the difficulty centered on a perceived issue of prestige with the senior research associate title. Research associate, which is often used right after postdoc, is common, but senior research associate fell into disfavor at our peers, and Cornell was finding it difficult to hire people at that level and felt that the promotion sequence to research associate was awkward. And so College of Engineering at that time, I was on the Engineering Policy Committee, brought to the Senate a proposal that we start to use research scientist titles. Our peers were doing that and in fact still use those titles, with the senior version being called principal research scientist and the initial version called research scientist, but with a dossier review even at that initial level. So we operated that way until 2015. Joe, can we have the next slide? Now, in 2015, when the professorial titles were introduced, there was an assumption that the majority of people in the research scientist titles would probably try to move over to these professorial titles, and that was stated in the debate. Yeah, if you go into the record, you see a discussion around that. John Silcano presented this. The Senate didn't really pursue that much. The dialogue at the time had to do mostly with the Senate toughening the standard for obtaining the research professor titles. And the tougher standard that was advocated and adopted was that a research professor was somebody who often would be a leader on bringing in research grants, that they would have a tenure-like evaluation for appointment to those proposals. We'd write to prestigious faculty at other institutions. There was actually a comment I found that because this is a group of people who only do research and don't teach, that the research expectations should actually be higher than for Cornell's expectations around tenure for tenure track researchers who have a balance of teaching and research. So there was a real feeling that these should have a tough standard associated with them, and the Senate imposed that. And with that, it was adopted. So you would see a research professor as a person who could obtain a tenured faculty position at a peer institution, in fact, but was choosing to bring in soft money, their own soft money often, run a research group or perhaps a laboratory, some kind of a larger center, and it would be a highly prestigious track. Now, at that time, if you think about it, effectively two types of titles had been frozen because as Dean DeRosa was explaining, we had agreed to stop using senior research associate and start using research scientist. In fact, in 2004, we asked that units consider moving any existing senior research associates directly to research scientists without a further review. And now at 2015, we ceased to use research scientist except in the research division, which means not available in general without a a special request from any other unit. There's still people who hold those titles, they're still on the books, but we can't make new appointments. So, for example, in College of Engineering and Computing Information Science, the Barrows College, we're unable to make new appointments on these research scientist titles. We're only able, in fact, to go back to research, to senior research associate. A decision was apparently made to honor the more recent decision, the 2015 one, and reverse the 2004 one. But the Senate was not consulted at that moment, and certainly the RTE faculty did not have a voice at that stage either. So this simply happened. And now, so let's move forward. The impact essentially is that it's you have a group of people who potentially can't qualify as research professors under the Senate standard, and are now being pushed back onto what we in the Senate perceived as a less prestigious title, senior research associate, which is not really used at our peers. They favor research scientists for individuals who would not get 12 very, very strong tenure-like letters and who don't have huge publication records and who don't perhaps supervise PhD students directly. So let's go to the next slide. Joe, could we have the, So as you can see, I highlighted them in pink. In College of Engineering and in the Barrows College, we are seeing renewed use of senior research associate for individuals who don't have the profile of the research professors, which are also being used on the white lines, but there are quite a few. As far as we can tell, there are about 10 people in this category by now. Jeff, we have the next slide. Now, our peers have not frozen the use of research scientists, and that's what brings me to you today. And I'm hoping that with your support, we'll simply reiterate our preference that our RTR colleagues have available to them the research scientist track. With that, the university would reauthorize use of those titles in units that wish to do so. We would still have the research professor track as well with the tough standard the Senate imposed. And as you can see, that would make us more competitive with CMU, MIT, University of Washington in Seattle, and so forth. Our peers are using this additional title, just as the Senate found in 2004. And so with that, the next slide, please. My proposal today is that we discuss a motion that we would actually vote on after the next meeting. So this is still a motion in preparation. And in fact, I would need some support from other faculty senators and other faculty to bring this forward. But with your support, to simply reiterate our preference and reauthorize the use of the research scientist titles. So, Joe, if you could, the next slide is a build because it's a long motion, but it just says the same things. So first, that whereas in 2004, the Cornell Faculty Senate determined that the senior research associate title, the senior being significant, because I don't think there is a concern about the initial use of research associate, to be unsuitable for our professional researchers, citing concerns about RTE professional stature and competitiveness. And Joe, and whereas the UFC draft of the more recently enacted research professor title assumed that research scientists would shift to this new rank and therefore recommended freezing use of the research scientist title, but the Senate subsequently strengthened the criteria for appointment to the research professor titles, limiting their use to Cornell's most prestigious RTE research appointments. Joe? And whereas the senior research associate title has consequently been revived without Senate consultation, which is, I don't want to go into that, by the way, recreating precisely the problems that the Senate tried to address in 2004. For the people for whom the research professor is inappropriate, our peer institutions favor the research scientist titles, Joe. Therefore, we reauthorize the use of research scientists. So I'm going to stop with that, and we open the floor. The only request being that we shouldn't engage in too much of a witch hunt of how this situation came about. even I've talked about, that it'd be much more constructive to go forward and just ask, what is the proper way to honor the accomplishments of our RTER colleagues, those who can become research professors? I'm very strongly in favor of that. But those who are on a slightly different track, don't publish quite as much, may not have quite the degree of international visibility, do we really intend that they have to go back to using senior research associate as is occurring now, or could we reauthorize the use of research scientist and principal research scientist? Thank you.
So if anyone has comments in person, walk up to the front. If you're online, raise your hand virtually. And I'll give you a second. Yeah, we have, is it Weijia Song online?
Yes. Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, okay, great. Yeah, thank you, Senator members, the member of the Senator, to bring this up. I'm a research associate in CIS since 2017. So it's already been more than 5 years, and my main focus is on building a system and doing research on cloud computing. I feel that without this title, my career path is kind of like sealed at Cornell. So if we can revive the research scientist, I think that would be a perfect title that I can go to for the next step. I just want to comment that. Thank you for bringing this up, and thank you for thinking about this. So this is something very important to people like me at Cornell. Thank you.
We have an in-person comment, and then we'll go back online.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Lam, and I'm RT representative for CALS, College of Ag and Life Sciences. And with knowing that this might open a hornet's nest, is there a reason for doing this just for research and not including the extension titles, which are relatively equivalent at the same time? Because I think some of the same problems occur. Thank you.
Go ahead, Eve.
Can I ask what those titles might look like?
Wait, come to the microphone.
There's extension associate, senior extension associate. Those are the two primary ones that I'm thinking of. Can you hear me?
And so is the, so I guess what's happening here is they have the associate and senior associate, and then they have the three-tiered research professor. Are you?
We don't have extension professors.
So is that, yeah, so that's what only, I'm trying to get. Is it the research scientist step,
so
or is it the,
okay. I think, because I think the extension scientist is what Ken's recommending, and I think that has more utility, perhaps, in this situation than an extension professor position. But I may be just, there may be people who disagree with me.
Yeah, but thank you for the clarification.
You know, I'm very sympathetic to your point, and I think that the RTE community has a number of issues that need to be addressed one by one by the Senate and by that community. This is a step, and it's not going to be the final step. And we have to think about the prestige and the career track of our colleagues at every level. And Cornell has gone through a period where the RTE researchers perhaps weren't treated exactly on a par with faculty. We're trying to change that, which is why now RTE faculty do have a vote here in the Senate. A significant number of faculty senators are RTE researchers. This particular step I'm advocating is intended to reverse a choice that was made that I think the Senate needs to think about, and I'm hoping will agree with me, isn't the preference the Senate would have expressed had we been consulted. But you're raising a different question, I would say, and I think it's an important one, in that I would hope that there would be further discussion and debate, and hopefully that something could be done for this extension group as well.
We have an in-person question or comment. Identify yourself, David.
David Delshantz, Electrical and Computer Engineering. It's a question. Okay, I'm trying to put the two presentations together. Am I correct in understanding, this is my first question, that the research scientist title still exists but requires special permission from somebody to give to a person?
Oddly enough, there's some confusion in the university itself about the whole question. There's no question that a research scientist and principal research scientists are still on the books. The trustees never removed them after they were put there. In Barris Computing Information Science and in College of Engineering, our understanding has been that we are not permitted to use them without a petition process that has to be initiated by the dean. In effect, that they are not available to us.
So wait, the dean can say yes, or the dean has to petition somebody higher up?
The dean seemingly has to petition someone higher up,
but
that process has not been pursued.
Right.
And in fact, the first I learned of it was Eve learned of it today. When Dean Bala inquired about this, she actually had the impression that CIS, at least, does not have access to this title anymore.
Okay. The second question I have. Okay, this is so great.
So according to academic HR, this title is available. So you'll see in the resolution when the research professor was brought, they did freeze new appointments except for in the research division. But according to academic HR, it is at the dean's discretion to bring this title in. So I have to give that nuance. So the resolution says that it's frozen for anyone outside of the research division. But from the perspective of academic HR, deans have the discretion. So it's messy.
Okay, what is the research division? That's the other question I had. I did not
divisions on campus that are exclusively research and do not have any tenure track lines.
Can you give me an example?
I was going to say Sizer or someplace like that.
Just curious. I heard that appellation and had no idea to whom or what it applied.
Let me just add one more thing. We consulted with John Silicano, the world expert on these things, and his email back said that the title was not available to us anymore. So
we do have another online question or comment from Catherine Caggiano. Okay. Oh, I see a different color. Mark Lewis then, and then Catherine.
Different color. Yeah. So Catherine can go first. It's fine. I can wait. Go ahead, Catherine. Go ahead, Casey.
Okay, sure. Thanks, Mark. I just wanted to make a comment in that it does look like, based on the way the title descriptions are currently written, that the research scientist and principal research scientist title are not permitted to teach without special approval by the dean. And the senior research associate, while that is not a title that is intended to teach, that they may teach courses that are consistent, it says, with the terms of the funding of the position. So I just wanted to point out that is a distinction that, whichever way we want to take this, may require some sort of clarification.
If I could, that is in fact the case. It also extends to research professors, by the way. The wording was that they would teach rarely. And it has been permitted. I know of cases, but it's considered to be rare. So it should not be the primary way that these individuals receive their compensation. And the argument for that at the time that the Senate discussed this was that you don't want to see a breakdown of traditional tenure piece by piece into people who do research but don't have tenure, people who teach who don't have tenure, and where teaching revenue would support the research professors. So there was a concern about that. And at the time, the Senate expressed this, and it was applied both to research scientists and principal research scientists, and then to the research professors. Senior research associate is a much older title, and the Senate never discussed this issue relative to that title.
I guess I'm just suggesting that it might bear discussion, right? Given that the wording makes it such that they are not permitted, right? It's a different type of level of flexibility than the senior research associate title currently has. So I guess I'm just suggesting that.
And there may be units that would want to continue using senior research associate for that reason. I agree.
Mark Lewis.
put my hand down, but I didn't turn my mute off. So just to clarify, it can be a part of your regular appointment. That's how it's written. So if you write an appointment letter for a research professor, they can teach on occasion, but it's not supposed to be a part of your regular appointment. That's just a comment to respond to Catherine's point. So I just wanted to say that when we, in the College of Engineering, because Ken, you mentioned it several times, when we did this research professor / research assistant associate to full professor, it was done with the understanding that there were only a few research scientists, and they were asked and polled if they would be willing to switch from what their titles were to with the new titles. So there was only three of them at the time, and I think two of them switched, and the other one became a full professor in CS. So it wasn't that they were just switched; it was that they were actually asked, and then they confirmed that that's what they wanted to do. These are supposed to be, I think, parallel appointments. So research scientists went to either assistant associate, depending on their tenure at Cornell and their seniority. Senior research scientists, I think, would go to full research professor, again, depending on that seniority. So I think that was the idea. I'm not quite sure what we're gaining here, except maybe we're having, instead of from research associate, senior research associate, three more levels in between. But I don't think they were meant to be in between. I think they're meant to be parallel appointments, with the professor title being something that helps people gain more notoriety because they're now called professor as opposed to being scientists. Okay, I look forward to your response, Ken. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Margaret. So I agree with that. In fact, the same thing occurred in Barra's CIS. We had one individual who was a principal research scientist, and it was moved over to be a full research professor without additional dossier review. But the intention was that for new promotions to these positions, that there would be a dossier review. And that, as the Senate expressed it in 2015, that the review for a research professor would be considerably more stringent than what was being used as the review criteria for a research scientist and principal research scientist. So that the research professor titles would not be easily available.
Okay, Risa Lieberwitz.
Yeah, thanks, Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. So what I want to suggest is that we have an RTE ad hoc committee that Eve noted is at work, and it sounds like they're, we got the update about the survey questions. I think it would be generally useful to know, what the RTE ad hoc committee is doing, but more specifically to this discussion, this would seem to be an appropriate kind of question to give to a committee that's looking at the status of RTE faculty. Rather than doing things piecemeal, but to look at things as a whole. And the other thing I just want to mention is that, titles matter, and I'm not saying they don't. I think titles do matter. But what I'd also like to put out there in the discussion generally, and this is part of the reason for giving it to a committee that's working on more than one issue with regard to RTE faculty, is that we should think about the content of people's employment conditions. And so, the kind of thing that Ken pointed to in terms of the concerns about maintaining tenure track positions and not undermining tenure had to do with the ways in which people need job security and need those kinds of employment conditions so that they can actually fully engage in the academic freedom, whether it's research or teaching or both, that people need that kind of protection. So it seems to me that it's the content of our colleagues' jobs that are the most important, and that it's not simply about titles, but it's about making sure that we respect our colleagues by making sure that they can exercise the same sorts of rights and privileges, not privileges really, but rights and employment conditions that all of us should be able to exercise so that we can actually fulfill the academic freedom that we should all be able to practice and exercise in the toward the goal of the public mission of a university. So I'd really like us to keep our focus on that kind of discussion as well. Thanks.
I'm Walker White, computer science. I'm also the RTE representative for CIS. While I'm in a teaching position, when I actually first started in computer science, I was actually in the type of position that Ken was talking about. And I just wanted to bring up something Ken keeps mentioning about the stringency of the research professor position, but there's another perspective I wanted to take a look at it, because again, this is something that at one point could have been my career track. In computer science, a lot of research projects are often working on software, and the impact of these research projects are not necessarily determined by the papers that are published, but the adoption and the use of this software out in the community. And you need long-term senior personnel who are not necessarily the people writing the papers working on these types of things to make those research projects viable. And indeed, at an industry, at a company, they would have a scientist role. So.
Thank you. And I think you might get back. Weijia Song.
Oh, I'm just agree with Walker. Yeah, I think we have an extra question.
Mark Lewis
from Mark.
Sorry, I just want to respond to that one point that Ken made at the end there about the dossier review. There's supposed to be stringent dossier reviews for each one of those promotions. And I think what was happening, I'm conjecturing, not complete conjecture, they weren't happening in a stringent way. But every one of the promotions, in fact, the reappointments are supposed to be subject to some stringent dossier reviews. Now, it just turns out that each one of those titles we talked about, the dossier review ends at the dean's level. So the deans can decide that they don't need a stringent dossier review if they want to. They don't go to the provost because they're dean's level appointments. So I just want to point that out, that it's possible that those things are supposed to have those reviews and they weren't happening. Thank you.
If I could just make two quick factual comments. So first of all, what Mark said is absolutely true. In Barrett CIS, there would be six external letters for it would have been research scientist. Now it's become senior research associate. There would be 12 external letters for the research professor track. So they're both dossier reviews and they're both quite stringent, but the degree of outreach is different. Also, speaking to something that Risa suggested, I actually think it would be a wonderful idea to get input from the Professional Careers Committee, the RTE committee. But I also think it's important to recognize that the Senate offers an actual vote, a genuine voice, to all of us, and we include representation of the RTE faculty. The RTE faculty were not consulted on an action which had an environmental impact for them. And this motion offers an opportunity for them to express a voice as well. They can vote it down. But the original 2004 view was that there was a question of professional prestige involved, and that because senior research associates not used by our peers in this way, that people felt awkward at conferences when they would encounter friends who had titles recognized and used at other universities, and they would be wearing a name tag that had a title which is not commonly used this way at other universities.
Risa?
Thanks. Risa Lieberwitz, ILR. I was surprised to hear that Ken said that there seems to have been some unilateral decision to freeze this title. I mean, if it's available, it's available. So, I don't actually have any problem with voting that it should be made available for use. But I do think that it makes a lot of sense to think about a Senate ad hoc committee that's going to be reporting to the Senate and perhaps vote, may have things to vote on, that if we're talking about titles for people on the faculty and here in the RTE area, that we should be also thinking about how the employment conditions in substance are determined, and that this should be seen as a whole. So I would suggest that since we have a Senate ad hoc committee in place, that it discusses the issue that Ken raised and these other substantive issues, which I hope they're discussing.
Are there other comments or questions in-house or online? I don't see any hands. I'm assuming there's no so-called good of the order today. Is that correct?
Risa, I just also wanted to say that I think that's a fabulous idea to bring it to the task force.
So we're about to adjourn. I would just make a plug for good of the order. I miss it. So send your ideas that are not necessarily ideas that are about a motion, but other things of concern at Cornell to the Dean of Faculty's office so that we can get you on the agenda for the next meeting.
I'm happy for people to... Oh, okay. We have Harold as well, but I just want to put a plug in for the good of the order as well. Anybody who plays an instrument, you want to come up and play music? We're happy to have that. So I just want to put a plug in.
So before adjournment, we have a few minutes. Harold Hodes, identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Harold Hodes from philosophy. I want to talk about giving the faculty a pay raise. During the COVID epidemic, we had contributions to our retirement frozen. The COVID epidemic was followed by a remarkable period of inflation that has not ended. We have not had a significant across the board pay raise. So in effect, we've had a pay decrease. So I think that the salary improvement program should recommend an across the board pay raise for the faculty of at least 10%. I'm not the only one in my department who is thinking this way. Most of my colleagues agree with this. So I hope that there's some way to get the SIP on board with this idea.
Harold, you're not alone. And I actually am trying to get the Financial Policies Committee to come to the Senate in November. And I think this would be a perfect topic for them to discuss. So thank you.
We have a few more minutes. So I see Allison online. Identify yourself.
Sorry for that. I did have a question about the makeup of the RTE ad hoc task force, and that was posted in the chat. The second issue that was discussed at one of the earlier meetings that I attended was having RTE faculty participate on all the faculty senate committees and have a vote on those committees. Has there been any move to consider that?
So Allison, the RTE committee has really good representation. So are there colleges or disciplines that you don't think are well represented? So that's one thing. And then we have RTE on many of the Senate committees. And so are you asking to just formalize that? Because in the guidebook, I don't think it's formalized, because RTE faculty did not, they weren't part of the faculty senate at that time. But for example, the Education Policy Committee is chaired by an RTE faculty member, Mark Milstein. So I guess I just wanted to get a sense of what exactly is it, what are we missing in terms of representation for discipline or college on the task force? And are you asking for the handbook or the guidelines to be updated? Because RTE are on Senate committees except for FACTA.
Tara? Okay, and do they have a vote on all those committees? That was something?
Yes.
Okay, I'm good.
And they chair some of these committees as well.
I'll have to go back and look.
Tara Holm?
Thanks. I'm sorry. I hope this hasn't been said. I was late because we have a faculty meeting earlier in the afternoon on Wednesdays. I'm Tara Holm from the math department. I've been hearing from some of my staff. Well, actually, this comment begins with our last Senate meeting when Paul Ginsburg was expressing frustration about the change in the calendar and the lack of communication from the registrar's office about that change and the reasons for that change and the fact that change had taken place, which really did affect the fall semester. I've heard from staff in my department about some other planned changes coming at the suggestion of the registrar. And I so those include, for example, shortening our ad drop period. And it seems to me that that is the type of thing that ought to be the EPC ought to be consulted about. And so I just wondered if that is happening or has happened and to what degree the Senate is aware of such things.
Thank you, Tara. As we mentioned last time, the EPC oversaw, so the registrar made a proposal for this year's academic calendar. It went to the EPC. We got feedback from the entire committee and they said, okay. And it was to meet the state regulations. And so we needed exactly, I believe it was 75 or 73 days. And so,
yeah, I understand why those changes happened, but I just wanted to make sure.
And then the second thing was the anticipated changes. Those have not come to the Office of the Dean of Faculty yet. So I'll reach out to the registrar, try to get that through EPC. So whatever I receive from the registrar will go to EPC for sure.
And we have maybe the final in-person comment. Identify yourself, please.
Andy Horbol, RTE, Faculty at Large Senator. To go back to Allison's comment, by way of clarification, at the August 31st, I believe 31st, orientation for the Senate, the clarification that RTE faculty are not eligible to serve on committees was an answer given in response to a question. And so Eve, I know you have communicated with me about putting together a listserv that RTE at large can use to communicate with the constituency. To respond to your question from my perspective, I think what would be helpful is to clarify that RTE faculty are eligible to serve on committees so that we can use that listserv to recruit RTE faculty to volunteer to serve on those committees. So whatever form that clarification takes, possibly clarifying in the handbook so that anyone who looks up if they're eligible can see that, I'd be supportive of that and help.
I think those are wonderful suggestions, and that's the work of, so Risa, you had asked about the work of the RTE task force. One of the things that the RTE task force are working on this year is constituency. Who are the people that they're representing? Because at this moment, it's not clear. So we're working on building community. So if you are the college representative for RTE, then you'll get all of the RTE. So we're giving IRP, Institutional Research and Planning Office, space to finish the survey and execute. And then we are going to get together as an RTE task force to get all of the people that RTE are representing at the college level and at large. So that's one thing. And we also are reaching out to find out how exactly to spell out that both RTE and university faculty are available or can volunteer to serve on our 12 Senate, well, 11 Senate committees, so they cannot serve on FACTA, which is the tenure review committee. I did find that out. Thank you. Thank you, everyone, also, especially seeing 30 people here. Yes. Thank you.
If there is a 2-minute comment, we have actually room. Otherwise, I don't see any hands, but I'll wait a second. Okay, I think we should just then, in that case, adjourn. And thank you. The meeting is adjourned.
And everyone here, please remember to sign in. Thank you.